I hit somebody in the head on number six, a lady who was in the gallery, because they used to let the gallery get right up next, or the patrons, as they
the
say,
patrons,
at
the
Augusta.
Patrons. Yes, yes.
And I go over and I apologize, et cetera, et cetera. And I go down to hit my little pitch shot. Look, there's blood on the ball.
Oh, get out of here.
So,
oh, my God.
Anyway, somehow I get that one up and down. Then
got
I
it up and down,
stagger
though.
In another 30-footer on eight. And I walk off the first nine holes, and I'm three under par. And I'm walking just gingerly trying to sneak off the back of the green without drawing any attention. And he announces, leading the Masters at this time, a young amateur from Virginia. And I mean, I choked like a dog. I hit eight greens in a fringe on the backside and shot two over.
That was the voice of none other than Vinny Giles, probably the greatest living American amateur golfer. Also perhaps one of the straightest shooters in golf. Not just in terms of his golf ball, pardon the pun, but in his thoughts and his takes and his ideas about golf courses, the state of the game, all those things that we're going to have the chance to listen to in just a couple minutes. My name's Tom Coyne. Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball and golf. I recently had the chance to visit the Kinloch Club in Richmond, Virginia. It's a pretty exceptional golf getaway. If you're ever invited, say yes. And down to the course that Mr. Giles helped bring to life and the place that he now calls home. It was an incredible thrill, actually. I got to play with Vinny Giles and his friend Bobby Watkins, Lanny's brother, former PGA Tour player himself. It was a really interesting morning, actually. I took a super early flight down to Richmond, got into the grill where they're having breakfast, and there's Vinny Giles, there's Bobby Watkins. My host, it turns out, is the leading scorer in East Carolina football history. There's Michael Vick, of course, was there, and then some dude I went to high school with, a friend of mine from high school. So pretty interesting morning. It was raining. Wasn't sure we were going to get to play, so we grabbed the mics, and Mr. Giles was kind enough to give us some of his thoughts on architecture courses and where golf is right now. At 78 years old, he's really thoughtful, very generous. Don't take his directness for grumpiness. He's a pure gentleman. And as a golf partner, I'd take him any day of the week. I have to say, I was feeling pretty good about my game down at Kinloch when the rain stopped and we got out there. I was finding the fairways, finding my ball pretty well down those fairways as well. Thanks, of course, to my TSI driver that I am very much in love with. If you haven't experienced it yet, the technology in the face of the TSI driver, and now in the fairway woods and as well, I mean, it is literally space age stuff. You find the metal in the face of the TSI line, and you also find it in the space program. Comes out of American made in Pittsburgh, but very unique product that's doing very unique things to the golf ball. I'm loving the ball flight and the distance that I'm getting. I'm also loving the sound. The Titleist carefully engineered the acoustics on the TSI line. So if you haven't checked it out yet, go to Titleist.com, get all the info about TSI, schedule a fitting, and indulge yourself. Holidays are coming. Make it happen. Also, exciting news from the Golfers Journal. You may have recently received an email. I hope you have, because I hope you're a subscriber, or the email's on the way if you are. And it's from our founder and chief, Brendan Thomas, about the new home for the Broken Tee Society, our new private Broken Tee Society server hosted on the Discord platform. Think about it as a clubhouse in the clouds. I mean, there's so many great features and possibilities and things we're going to do with this. It's much more than a message board. I don't want to go on too much about it here, other than to just say, get on there. It's a blast, and it's really easy. I'm not terribly technologically inclined. Took me about 5 minutes to get set up and going. And also, I want to say it's free. It's just more value that comes with the Golfers Journal membership. So if it's time to up your subscription again, make sure that you do. Also, quick thanks to the brands that are part of the Golfers Journal, and they are Titleist, Link Soul, FootJoy, Oakley, Links and Kings, and Scotty Cameron. And now let's turn it over to our new friend, Vinny Giles. And when Vinny says that if he shoots his age, 78, he's played terribly, I can attest he is not kidding.
I was approached back in probably 1997, 98 by C.B. Robertson, who owned about 750 acres, Goochland County, Virginia, a beautiful 70-acre lake in the middle of this property. He was ready to develop it into a residential community and asked me if I would build a golf course for him. And I responded no. And he looked at me kind of askance and said, well, why not? I said, well, first of all, because I don't know how. I said, and that's fairly critical. I said, I can get a routing for you. I can get you from point A to point B. I think I know where to place tees and greens. I know where to place bunkers. But I have no clue about the critical elements like drainage. I can read a topo map. Very simply, 0, 10, 20, 30, it means nothing to me. If you would consider letting me bring in an architect, a true golf course architect with the ability to do the heavy lifting, I would love to get involved. We brought in Lester George, original plan being a daily fee golf course, upscale daily fee, which in Richmond, Virginia, 20 years ago was probably a $50 green fee number. I walked the property after we rough cleared it and immediately fell in love with a piece of land. It's a phenomenal piece of land. And Tom has not yet seen it, but hopefully we'll see it before the day's over. It's got a lot of elevation change. It's got some beautiful movement to it. And unlike so many of today's modern architects, we moved a grand total of 160,000 yards of dirt.
Really?
Typical architect today, well, go to a place like, you can pick a lot of them. I mean, they're moving a million yards of dirt. The land was here, and I went back to Mr. Robertson and said, would you consider a very probably not intelligent financial move, would you consider making it a golf club, a pure golf club, and basically means trying to sell 300 memberships and bring in a bunch of people who just love to play the game. He said, why? I explained to him that I thought he had a unique piece of land. And that's really how we got to Kenlock. I mean, Kenlock was going to be a Bermuda grass, fast-playing, as I mentioned to Tom earlier. If you clear wide corridors and let people not have to hunt for balls, you can add four or five foursomes a day, and that in public golf is revenue. So we went to bent grass, which was not done at all in the Richmond, Virginia area, to be unique, and basically started up a campaign to sell memberships and create a special place. And it was a struggle. We came and we opened October of 2001, right after 9/11. Wasn't a great time. We struggled through the 2008-09 period. Right now, Kenlock's the healthiest it's ever been. We've got a great membership. We've got a wonderful staff. Probably the hallmark of Kenlock is the service model that originally was developed by Phil Owenby, who was our first director of golf /general manager. Has been continued by his successor, Jonathan Ireland. And everything that I love hearing about the golf course, obviously, because Lester and I do feel like we created a wonderful golf course. But people come here and they've been here for 20 minutes and they say, I feel like I was a member. I was treated so well. People knew who I was, what I liked, et cetera. That to me is really what sets Kenlock apart. It's Southern hospitality. It's fun. It's laid back, and there's very little pretense at Kenlock.
I would have to agree. I've only been here 20 minutes, Vinny, and I do feel
You've made me feel very welcome. Having breakfast with Bobby Watkins, that's pretty great as well. And everyone's just been really, really, really welcoming. So you mentioned looking at the golf course as a player. And that's really what I want to talk about with you, is your extraordinary playing career as a lifetime amateur golfer and your commitment to the amateur game. Your resume, just off the top of my head, please correct me and add to it. Multiple U.S. Opens you've played in, two at least?
I played in only two, yeah. Okay. I actually, to be honest, once we started our business, Pros Incorporated, in 73, and I did play in the 73 Open because I was exempt from the 72 amateur. I just decided I couldn't play in qualifiers because it, just say that I happened to get the last spot in a qualifier at XYZ, and the first alternate is one of my clients. You know, what's my option? I've got to move aside and let my client play in the U.S. Open because it's a lot more important to him than it is to me. So I am an attorney by education only, Tom. I would not I would not trust me to go to court for you. we were, for lack of a better term, we were sports agents. When I got out of law school in 69 and decided not to, I actually decided out of college at 66 not to try to play the PGA Tour for various reasons. 69, when I got out of law school, I really went to law school because I decided not to play golf for a living. And I said, I need to go get a little background because I'd spent a lot of time playing golf in college. And was fortunate, very fortunate, to get into law school at the University of Virginia because I'm not, other than the fact that the director of admissions was a jock, I don't think I'd have gotten in. But 69, I knew I wasn't really planning on practicing law. I just really wanted the background, the education. And I went in the investment business with a company called Wheat First Securities in Richmond. That's when I moved to Richmond, the fall of 69. And stayed there for about 4 years and had some young players asking me to help them with contracts, with investments, et cetera. I mean, I kind of laughed. They would say, oh, well, you're a lawyer in the investment business, so you must know that. I said, well, you know, between myself and myself, I don't know a damn thing. I mean, there's a lot I haven't learned, but I was helping a couple people, Alan Miller, Bobby Watkins, we worked with that you mentioned earlier. And all of a sudden, a friend of mine and I just went down and said, look, we've been fiddling around with this thing. The name in the business was obviously Mark McCormick. I mean, he was the IMG. That was the big firm. There were a couple other smaller ones. And we started a business from scratch in April of 1973. In fact, our first official business trip was to go to the Masters for me to play in the Masters and, you know, scratch around, try to make some contacts and get something started.
Wow.
So that was, as I said, I was 30 years old, and I said, you know, if it doesn't work, if I screw it up, I won't be more than 33, 4, 5. I'll go back and do something else.
So going to the play in the Masters for most people is not a business trip.
we called it a business trip. Right. It wasn't a business trip. I mean, it was funny because that was 73, strangely enough, was probably the best year I ever had in competitive golf. I mean, I just happened to have one of those years when you played well. And I only played in August, really, because of work. I mean, I played the whole month of August. I would play in the Porter Cup, the Eastern Amateur, and that year the Walker Cup, and then the U.S. Amateur. So you literally had, I mean, August was golf.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I could tell from the first event, which I think was usually the Porter Cup, until through the U.S. Amateur, I'd get 10, 12 yards longer off the tee just from reps.
Yeah.
You know, stretching muscles, you know, and just being more flexible and more fluid. So, but no, going to the Masters was, you know, I had won the U.S. Amateur the year before, so I had a nice. I probably played with Nicklaus. I don't remember. I played with Nicklaus in the Open, the first two rounds of the Open that year. And I don't know if I played with him at Augusta. I've forgotten who won the Masters, but in 72. But, you know, I would have been paired with them
right.
the following year.
I wish I had it on the top of my head. I don't. But when you say it's so interesting to say that if you qualified for the Open, you could be taking one of your clients' spots. I mean, I can't think of another sports agent or manager or money manager or whatever you want to call who could play at the level that you played at. And that combination is pretty – well, you're one of a kind, really. If you look, again, multiple U.S. Opens, you played in a lot of Masters. How many Masters?
I played nine.
Nine Masters. And that comes from your USAM.
I haven't talked about it a lot, but my proudest, and I didn't really think about it until I went back and reflected, my proudest accomplishment, I guess, Tom, in golf, from a longevity standpoint, is starting in 1967. I finished second in the U.S. Amateur in 67, 68, and 69.
Wow.
I finished sixth in 1970 when Lanny Watkins won. I finished third in 1971. I finished first in 1972, and I lost in the semifinals when they went back to match play in 1973.
I had
a 7-year period where my worst, I had one finish outside of the top three in the U.S. Amateur, which nobody knows about. But when I went back and reflected on it, I said,
I'm not sure
Bobby Jones accomplished that.
No.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident that he did not. That is extraordinary.
So you know something now that probably nobody else in your profession knows.
And thankfully.
And nobody pays any attention to.
Well, we're paying attention to it here. That's absolutely extraordinary. And at the same time, you're a working guy. What was the secret to your success? How did that happen? Was it, you know, like you said, you got better in August. You know, what – you had the USAM's number.
Why? Really. I mean, honestly, when I lost in 67 because of a couple of funny rulings that had Joe Dye's mother not died, I think I'd have won the Amateur in 67.
Wait,
there were a couple of strange.
Well, how does that work? Wait, make the, what happened
well,
there?
Well, I mean, the fourth round, I'm playing with the eventual champion, Bob Dixon. On the first hole, he hits his tee shot out of bounds. He hits a provisional. They get down there, then he hit the same ball for his provisional, same number ball. And they're two balls. One's inbounds and one's out of bounds.
Ooh.
And they're not marked.
Ouch.
And a spectator says, well, we saw your first ball hit in the asphalt over out of bounds. And the official, who was the president of the USGA, who didn't have a clue about the rules, deemed that the ball inbounds was his ball. Well, we both know what that rule is. If you can't identify your ball, that's end of story.
Yeah.
We got to 18, which is 72nd hole. I had just made birdie. To be honest, I was an unknown.
Yeah.
I had won the Southern Amateur that summer, but I was a law school student. I just finished my first year of law school. I did make college All-American my senior year at Georgia. So I'm and not an unknown, but not a name.
Mm-hmm.
All I was thinking about back then, the top eight made the Masters.
Oh, top eight.
Well, my lifetime dream had been to play in the Masters.
Yeah.
And so I all of a sudden look at the leaderboard on about the 16th hole, and I look up, and Bob Dixon and I have separated us. I said, well, hell, I'm in the Masters. So this isn't a problem. Now I can think about winning the golf tournament. And I made birdie at the 71st hole and got within one shot, and 18 was a pretty good hole. It was at Broadmoor. And I hit a good tee shot right in the middle of the fairway. He hit a duck hook over in some trees, and a friend of mine was out there. I didn't go over that. I didn't figure it was any of my business. He was next to a tree with basically, and my friend came out and gave me the thumbs down on his shot, said, only shot he's got is to hit it backwards out into the fairway about 60 yards short of my ball. Now we're tied, and I'm going to be 60 yards closer to the green than he is. Well, he's a tall guy. There was a television cable running up through the pine trees. He takes a swing and hits the television cable, but it's not where he could, not where he could have hit his ball. The same official gave him relief.
Really?
He pitched the ball down in front of the green, got it up and down for par. I made par, and he won by a shot.
So very
I'm
interesting.
I'm pretty sure, as I say, that if Joe Dye had been there, because he at the time was the was executive director of the USGA.
Okay, so that's why he wasn't
and
there.
And Joe knew the rules.
Yeah.
That would neither one of those things would have happened.
That's
not to say that maybe something didn't happen between 1 and 18 that could have changed the scenario.
Sure. Nine Masters. Give us, looking back on your experiences at Augusta, is there a highlight or a memory that stands out to you from that time, from those experiences?
Well, strangely enough, the first Masters, and here's a I mean, this is 68. Yeah, because I'd finished second in the Amateur in 67, which got me in. 68, I'm in law school. I have not played any competitive golf from probably August until until right then. And so no great expectations. I was going to try to go down early, go down Saturday. We had Saturday classes in law school. I was going to try to leave as soon as class was over on Saturday and go down. It gave me, if I got there fast enough, maybe I could play nine holes Saturday and then
it's
Sunday.
It's not to interrupt. It's amazing how things have changed. That you're making the choice between going to class and a practice round for the Masters.
Yeah.
I just love that.
So anyway, Thursday morning, I think it was, either Thursday or Friday, I wake up. My wife and I had gotten married right out of college, and we had this little one-bedroom house that we lived in. We rented. And I got up and about 6 o'clock in the morning. I said, I can't stand it any longer. And I packed right then. Got in my little car and took off for Augusta. And we played, I think I played 18 holes on that Thursday. I think it was a Thursday. We played all day Friday, all day Saturday. I mean, we played so many holes of golf and played the par three and just, it was like going to camp. I mean, we were just having a total vacation. And all of a sudden, it gets to be Thursday morning of the tournament. And I can honestly say it's probably the most nervous I've ever been. I can just remember, all I remember is it was a beautiful, sunny day. It was probably 75 degrees, a little whisper of wind. And I looked at my pant leg on the first tee, and it looked like it was a hurricane blowing. but I start out, Tom, and back then there weren't any trees to speak of to the left of the fairway, little scrub pines, other than the big ones, which were more on nine. And I said, well, I'm not going in that bunker, so I hit it over the left. I remember saying to my caddy, it's a 5-iron distance. But I said, I'm so pumped up, I'm going to hit the 6-iron. I hit a 6-iron, got it on the green. Made about a 30-footer.
Wow.
And got around to 5. I parred the next 3 holes. I got around to 5. I've got a putt out of that bowl, impossible putt up over the hill from about 40 or 50 feet, and I make it. Now I'm 2 under.
Ooh.
I hit somebody in the head on number six, a lady who was in the gallery, because they used to let the gallery get right up next, or the patrons, as they
the
say,
patrons,
at
the
Augusta.
Patrons. Yes, yes.
And I get, then I go over and I apologize, et cetera, et cetera. And I go down to hit my little pitch shot. Look, there's blood on the ball.
Oh, get out of here.
So,
oh, my God.
Anyway, somehow I get that one up and down. Then
got
I
it up and down,
stagger in another 30-footer on eight, and I walk off the first nine holes, and I'm three under par. And you're too young to remember, but they used to have a couple of guys that had an announcer on the ninth green and on the 18th green that announced who was playing, et cetera. And I, having gone to Georgia, I knew the guy. His name was Leo Beckman. And I'm walking just gingerly trying to sneak off the back of the green without drawing any attention. And he announces, leading the Masters at this time, a young amateur from Virginia. And I mean, I choked like a dog. I hit eight greens in a fringe on the backside and shot two over.
Still.
But, you know, I got around in one under par.
Yeah,
and long story short, that was the year DeVincenzo signed the Bronx scorecard.
Oh, was it?
I played a solid three more rounds and shot even par. Finished, I think, in the top 20.
Did you get low am that year?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you
had, that was the only year I was low amateur.
That was the only one?
I made either three or four cuts out of the nine, but that was the best I ever played.
Oh, that is so cool. I assume you go back?
I have gone up until 19, I guess, which was obviously, or 20.
Mm-hmm.
What's this, 21?
Yeah.
I guess it was 20, yeah. Up until 20, I think I'd missed one since the early 60s.
You've been able to see a change over time.
Yeah. With our business and what have you, I mean, it was pretty mandatory that you be there. I did not go in 20, and I did not go this year. I'm not working anymore, so it wasn't even business reason. I just basically went up to see people toward the last part, so. Of the time.
Has it changed more or has it stayed the same more?
Obviously the golf course has changed a lot. I mean, it's way longer than it used to be. It's probably a little more formal than it used to be. It used to be a little more relaxed, more fun. I think it's... It's not as much fun. It's not as loose. It's, you know, you've seen all the building they've done. I mean, the place is a town now,
for sure.
Hell, they buy whatever they want. They build, you know, they buy roads, they buy, you know, whatever. But it's a real production today.
So, you know, going on from the Masters to playing in Walker Cups, captaining a winning team, I believe, in the Walker Cup. British winning the British Am. I mean, how do you? Well, first, you alluded to it quickly before the decision to not go professional. Can you just give us a little insight into that? Because people would be wanting, you know. Well, I'm wondering myself.
Twofold.
You know, when you get to that point.
One was I have been, you know, I think I've been very, very fortunate to have been able to play golf the level I did. I probably more so then than now, maybe a lot more. I just love playing golf.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. And one of my thoughts about the tour, and again, you're going back to 1966, and, you know, people say, well, there wasn't any money in it. That's true. There wasn't any money in it. I mean, the total purses in 1966 were $66.5 million. Yeah.
Total.
These stars won't even show up for a one tournament for
$65.5 million.
Yeah. Purse isn't big enough. I wasn't sure it was going to be fun. I mean, I never forget reading something that Billy Casper had said about it's nothing but an 8-to-5 job. You just do the same damn thing every day, et cetera. And I said, you know, is that going to be any fun? I didn't have a whole lot of real close friends that were out there. I got married right out of college, and my wife wasn't a bit interested. I mean, we laugh all the time about, she said, you know, I'm not sure I want to spend the rest of my life in a Holiday Inn. And I said, we never got into the discussion, but little did she know back then the Holiday Inn was about a 4-star. I said, we'd have been more like in the Motel 6.
But, Holiday Inn, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Anyway, it just didn't happen. I mean, it was a couple of mitigating factors out there, and it never quite happened. And then people said, why didn't you play the Champions Tour? And I said, well, at 50 years old, I had a lot of obligations to some very good clients that had been loyal clients forever. I couldn't just walk away from it. So,
yeah. Well, I think as an amateur, that puts you in an interesting place, and that's why I wanted to ask you, what do you think about the state of amateur golf today? I mean, it's a lot of great players. It's great to watch. But even, you know, the AM and now the mid-AM, but even mid-AMs, it seems to me, my impression watching it, and especially the AM, which to me is an extension of college golf. There's players that are playing full-time. And the mid-AM, you even have some guys that might be playing full-time as well, who aren't running companies like yourself or like a friend of mine, Michael McDermott, who runs a company and is a full-time, you know, golf is his pastime and his joy and is the thing he loves to do, like you. So what's your take on the state of what we call amateur golf?
I'm going to be somewhat candid and probably somewhat less than knowledgeable, but I don't think the USGA has come close to doing their job in promoting amateur golf, especially at the mid-AM level. I mean, you can say the U.S. Amateur now is nothing but a junior tournament. I don't think you'll ever see a player over 20, I'll say to be safe 25, ever even be in contention to win a U.S. Amateur. First of all, the U.S. Amateurs played it the wrong format. I mean, you now have 500 really great college players, and you got 200 that are going to be professionals soon after getting out of school, and you throw them into a match play format. If you go back and look at the match play format, you rarely do one of the best players in the event win. I don't know the young man, Mr. Pyatt, this year, but where is he ranked in the World Amateur Golf Rankings prior to the U.S. Amateur? I doubt that he was in the top 75. You know, the medalist shot, 10 or 12 under par and lost in the first round. I love match play golf, but you can't determine the national champion with the talent out there today. You're not going to have the best champion very often. I made the argument 20, 30, 40 years ago, 45 years ago when the U.S. Amateur was here in Virginia. I said, go look at the record. When you had stroke play, the top 10 from a stroke play event, and they had stroke play from 65 through 72, the top 10, there were probably 6 pre-tournament favorites in the top 10 at the end of the week. You go to match play and look at the quarterfinalists, and you'll find maybe 2 that are left. It's an argument to me that can't be you can't defend match play against stroke play to determine the best player. I mean, in a perfect world, you'd have a match play U.S. Amateur and a stroke play. Call one thing and one another thing.
Right.
I'm digressing a little bit, Tom, every country has a developmental team The USGA has no developmental team. The answer is, oh, the colleges do that. I mean, we're supposed to be the golf country in the world, and yet we do very little to promote and bring along underprivileged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I just think amateur golf, quite honestly, the USGA cares primarily about the U.S. Open because that is the source of revenue. And I don't think they really get their heart and soul into amateur golf at all. Alan Fidel, who's a close friend of mine, started this Amateur Golf Alliance. We did the Concession Cup. We tried to really promote mid-am senior golf. The USGA hadn't gotten behind it. They threw us a bone of like $15,000 to help offset some expenses. But they've never gotten behind it. They could take it and run with it.
Hmm. That's a cool format because you have the senior am, the mid-am, and the regular am.
We've had a ball with it. I mean, I captained the first three teams. But we can't get it to go overseas because GB and I's won't. One, they don't even care about mid-amateur golf. They don't have a mid-amateur championship anymore, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't believe
it. And, they're not going to fund it. We end up funding the whole thing. We brought their team over and funded their team as well.
Huh.
We are trying to promote it throughout Europe, more the Ryder Cup type, where you'll play Europe or even rest of the world against the Americans. But until we get a little cooperation from somebody, it's not going to happen.
Well, I hope it does. It's cool.
It's a great thing. You think of the players that never played Walker Cup who are amateurs, and I think of a guy like Scott Harvey, for instance, mm-hmm. Paul Simpson, some really good players that came along later. They absolutely adored playing for their country.
Yeah.
It meant a ton to them.
Previously mentioned, Michael McDermott played in the Concession Cup.
Yeah, Michael played on our last team. He was a absolutely wonderful teammate. And of all the nice letters and things that I got from being the captain, which I didn't do a daggone thing except say, guys, have some fun. The nicest letter I got, beautifully written and well thought out, was from Michael McDermott.
I can believe that for sure. It's first class, indeed.
Yep.
So, Vinny, I'm going to wrap things up with just a few tough questions for you. Best golf tip you ever got? Best tip for our listeners out there?
It's funny. As I think back on it, I never really had much formal instruction. I grew up at a little club called Boonesboro Country Club in Lynchburg, Virginia. We didn't have a golf pro until I was about 15. we really learned how to swing a golf club by caddying primarily.
Yeah.
I mean, my father, fortunately, was a good player. I mean, he got down to about a one handicap. In fact, the first year that I won our Virginia State Amateur, the same day in the same, not on the same course, but in the same location at the Homestead at Hot Springs, my father was playing the finals of the State Senior Amateur the same day I was playing in my first State Amateur final.
Wow.
So I got to caddy in his group, and they had about 16 or 20 of them played every Saturday and Sunday. So I got to watch the better players and learn something from them. When we did finally get a golf pro, he was sort of the guy that refined me, I guess. I mean, I could go to see him and spend 30 minutes and anything that I thought was off was fixed. I can't say it was a specific tip. We spent hours hitting little pitch shots and bunker shots. And, I mean, it's kind of funny because, up until I was 65 or thereabouts, I thought I was as good around the greens as anybody in the world. I mean, I thought I could get it up and down there with a garbage can. I mean, I could do any. And all of a sudden, it's kind of like the yips with a putter. Boy, when it left, it left. And I'm not worth a damn anymore.
Get out.
I don't know where it went, but you know how the mind, yeah, plays those games with you. It got me pretty good, but nothing specific. I still don't. I would say I'm self-taught. I've been very lucky to have a simple golf swing. The only thing I try to do to maintain it today is flexibility. I just try to do a lot of stretching and, you know, I mean, 78 years old, the ball falls out of the sky a lot faster than it used to. But you just deal with it. You move up a tee if you have to.
Sure. So you're probably shooting below your age.
I can break. If I don't shoot below my age, I have played like crap.
That was a silly question, but just wanted for folks to know. That's amazing. Favorite golf course aside from Kinloch? I mean, so you seem to spend most of your time here.
Don't have a favorite per se. I mean, I love Seminole. I'm fortunate to get to play in the winter. I love Pinehurst number 2, although if they keep messing with it, it isn't going to be the same Pinehurst number 2 it used to be. My answer to that question, Tom, has always been, if somebody told me I could play all the golf I wanted but only on one course, it would be Cypress Point.
Well said.
And only because of the walk. I think it's the most overrated golf course in the world. I mean, what do we look at? 3 on the ratings?
Yeah.
I mean, if you really go by, and I'm sure you've seen plenty of it, if you go by hole, there's some really average, and I'm being nice, average holes on that golf course. I mean, you go right next door, Pebbles are much better laid. But Cypress has that wonderful, and I used to be lucky to go out in the fall with a friend and stay for about 5 days, and you wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning because you're on East Coast time. And I'd just go ahead and walk a golf course. I'd go down in the ocean on 16 and, you know, the whole shooting match. I just think it's a beautiful walk.
Yeah, it is.
Best hole on the golf course is 15.
Yeah. Yeah, 15. 15. Well, 16's not bad.
No, well, but it's different. You know, I mean, that's not for the average player. That hole's impossible.
It is.
You know.
It's your donation.
Unless you get smart, you just hit 6-iron wedge.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It is such a great walk. But I was saying, it sounds like you're here a lot here at Kinloch. You're living the area. You're here probably
every
day. I am
probably here if I'm in town, I'm here at least 5 days a week.
Fantastic. So if any of you know, if you have the chance to come up and get an invite to Kinloch, definitely say yes. Make sure you look for Mr. Giles. It has been an absolute honor to speak with you. I got the invite. I didn't know that I was going to get the chance to meet you until recently. It was so excited to get the chance to, well, I don't know if we're going to get the chance to play golf, but to get the chance to talk with you has just been a thrill. So thank you so much for the
time. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm glad we had a chance to do it, and hopefully we'll get out there and play a few holes anyway.
I hope so.